The title of the talk is I Believe in Me. It's in English, of course. I was surprised to find myself this morning in the village of Mashhad near Nazareth, near Nazareth. I had a meeting there, but I ended up having a two-hour discussion with a large group of Arabs in Mashhad who were arguing with me about God. And we had a long... I don't usually get into this, but it's not a good idea for Buddhists to get involved in arguments about God. But anyway, I couldn't resist. They were very interested and so on and so on. At first they said, you're a heretic, kofir. But in the end they said, okay, we understand you're a Sufi. But what was interesting was the fact that they really needed to believe in a world of reward and punishment from God. Sachar va'onesh. They needed to believe it. And they needed to believe that there was a father in the sky. These were quite sophisticated, educated people, but they felt without that belief naked and lost in a way. We are very, very full of beliefs. And of course we have gross beliefs, like if we believe in the Messiah, or we believe in democracy, or we believe in that we are right and others are wrong, and these are very obvious beliefs. There are very many not so obvious beliefs that we have that we don't even know about them. Assumptions, hanachot. For example, that the way we think is sensible. I had this experience in the work with peace work that we did, bringing Israelis and Palestinians together. And Israeli, often Dharma practitioners like us, who couldn't understand why the Palestinians didn't want to meditate or didn't understand questions of silence and quiet and didn't like it very much and didn't accept that maybe we were coming from a culture, a more psychological culture, a more Western culture, a more Dharma culture. We don't know even how much the beliefs are building in us all the time. And then there are really, really deep beliefs, which you maybe not call them belief, but in a way they are. And one of them is in the self. I exist means the I, an I, a self, is an existing thing that's controlling my life, what I do, what I think, and it owns the body, and it owns everything that I own, belongs to me, the self, that's sitting here somewhere in the middle. It's a very deep-seated belief. There's another one. Belief that I am not the Buddha. It's a belief. The belief that I am not awake, totally enlightened, and that I cannot be the next 5 minutes. It's a belief. Now you can say it's very deep. Twice in the course of this retreat, participants, yogis in the retreat, have told me about something which I do know about, which is that all our experiences are kind of mapped in the brain as networks between neurons, cells in the brain. The assumption being that everything is kind of hardwired and we can't change. That the brain is sort of structured according to our experience. If we know what a tree is, it's because the tree is somehow built in the networks of the brain. This may be true. This may be true up to a point. But the opposite is also true. That everything, as we heard last night, or you heard last night from Iran, that everything is a dynamic, that everything can change. In the Dharma language, the networks in the brain of engraved in the brain of the brain cells are kind of mapping the world. We can call it sankharas. The Buddhist term meaning traces, maps, structures in the conscious and the unconscious. But it's still very dynamic, and we can change it, and we do change it. And this is what really the talk is about tonight. The Buddhist practice, the Buddha Dharma, the practice that we're doing of Dharma, is actually moving us away from belief. Because belief, in a sense, is making those networks in the brain, those sankharas, strong. It's making them immovable, especially if we believe we're right. And you know, and is so also, by the way, the Buddha was so concerned with human suffering, and we know how much our beliefs cause suffering to others. We know how much the belief of the Americans that they're bringing freedom to Vietnam caused the death of 3 million Vietnamese in the name of freedom. The 3 million poor Vietnamese have to die because of the American concept of freedom. We are right. And there's all kinds of jihad going on in the world all the time, from all different sources. And the British did a lot of damage in the world by thinking that we are the Anglo-Saxon British way of life is superior and almost everybody else are animals. That's a belief. And you can see how much damage beliefs do. Leave that aside. The Buddha story of the Buddha as mythology or as teaching story, the Buddha left his palace when he got the shock. He got the shock of seeing suffering, disease, death, poverty. He didn't see it before. It was for him a big shock. It was similar to the shock of someone receiving the news from the doctor that they have cancer. Similar. And the same thing happened. He went off in a search, not for belief, but to inquire into the truth. What actually is going on? And it's very similar to many, many of us that get a shock. It's like the story of Eeyore, of Job, the book of Job, exactly the same. Shock, suffering. I've got to get to the bottom of this. So the Buddhist way has been like that ever since. A way of inquiry and not a way of belief. The Kalama Sutta, very famous Buddhist text, says, don't believe in something because the books say it, the old men say it, the so-called the priests say it, or the newspapers say it, or everybody says it, or the advertising says it. Believe it only if you hear the wisdom and you try it for yourself and you understand that it does good to yourself and to others. It's helpful to yourself and to others. In other words, test things out. Try things out. So the Buddhist practice is a practice of inquiry, of checking out, of finding the truth. As Krishnamurti says, it's the truth that frees us, not the effort to be free. The truth that frees us. When we realize truth, that frees us. Not that I want to be free. That doesn't free us. So what have we been doing? What are we doing here? Meditating, sitting and walking. We are in a way exploring ourselves. We are looking at ourselves as much as possible with an atmosphere of inquiry, of openness, exploring what's going on in our life. What is it? What are we made of? What's going on? And part of that is a bit of a boring process. We look breath after breath. Oh, I have to sit and breathe, and don't know why I have to breathe, but I just breathe and see the breath and another breath and another breath. How many breaths, after all, can anyone expect from me? What am I supposed to do? A whole week of checking breath after breath? And walking, oh my God. Going nowhere. Step after step, being a child. Again, I've passed that stage. But we forget perhaps that what we're doing is widening our view of ourselves. Because if this network in the brain that's holding us, in a way, imprisoned in a map of how the world is, interpretation, belief, solid, unchanging, then the way to open this, the way to bring new life, dynamic, into our knowing, which is what the brain is, our knowing, is to open the automatic world in us. To begin to see that what is automatic, our life, automatic pilot, tayas automati, is actually not automatic at all. And we start with the breath. Because it's there, it's good, it's a good place, it's a little subtle, and it opens mind and body together. The breath is a kind of bridge between mind and body. So we see the body, we see the mind, we see our restlessness, we see our patterns coming up, we see the stress, we see the pains, we begin to open the whole package. But we start with what's normally automatic and open that. That's why we start with the breath and the body and the walking and simple things. It's the ordinary which has built all those so-called fixed engravings in the mind, the sankharas. So we open the ordinary. And we look at our patterns, we look at our difficulties straight in the face, instead of ignoring them, pushing them down. And you remember the story that I told a couple of days ago about the woman dreaming of the demon chasing her. In the end, we see that we can look even at the patterns that hold us tight, that they are possible to look at. They are softened, we can practice, we can watch ourselves, we can begin to see new things, we can begin to see that every breath is a new and different experience. That's not automat, that's opening the dynamic process.
of knowing. And that breaks and softens the network of sankharas, of patterns in the brain. And it doesn't matter quite what we do. For example, the staff here in the retreat are also practicing. They're cooking, they're doing, they're acting, but with a certain consciousness where, like at home, we might just do the dishes, automatic, duck, 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 duck. Here, there's an opportunity, for example, in the staff, or if you're cutting vegetables, to do the same thing, not automatic. How am I acting? What is the movement that I'm doing? How am I with myself at this moment? How am I in movement, action, intention, service? So it doesn't really matter whether we're actually sitting, serving. It's all practice. It's opening a world. It's mirror to ourselves. Opening our world of automatic, bringing it dynamic. And one of the things that we begin to understand, and one of the first truths that we may come up with, is indeed that we are conditioned. That we are patterned. That there are patterns that keep coming up again and again. And it might depress us and think, oh, we can't change. Because they keep coming up. The same thoughts, the same feelings, the old anger keeps coming. The judgmental mind. Bikorit, you know, judging myself. Oh, not again. Oh, it's the same thought again. Oh, how many more times have I got to have this thought that I failed, I don't do well, it's no good, I'm no good. Or the other one is no good, or he's no good, or she's no good, or why did they do that? Or how many more times? Every day, 500 times. This is crazy. But that's a truth. If we see that we are conditioned, mutne, that we are conditioned. We are controlled by conditions. We are formed by the life, shaped by our life since we were born, shaped by habits, shaped by influence, shaped by what happens to us, shaped by our parents, by our society, collecting beliefs, collecting views, putting them down, ignoring them, they become sankharas, they become stuck inside us. Just that already is a big insight. And we can begin to touch it. And it may be difficult for us, but when we touch that sense of being controlled by conditions, we also touch something vulnerable in us. We touch something fragile, that we are made by conditions so we're not so strong, and we're suffering. We are subject to patterns and control and so on. So we learn this kind of truth from watching ourselves, even if it's a bit depressing. Now, if that was all, then we would be in trouble. Because we'd end up with a depressing view of ourselves and of life. We'd be quite miserable, and I think this is why many philosophers are relatively miserable. Nietzsche said, the only way I can get to sleep at night is by knowing that it's possible for me to shoot myself in the morning. He's one of the greatest philosophers of our Western world. Wittgenstein, very miserable sometimes in his life, very lost. Great philosopher, beautiful insight. We can't stay there though. It's not enough. We have to keep going. And I must say that in contrast to that, I've never really seen a real tzaddik, and a tzaddik or a Buddhist tzaddik, a Buddhist sage, a wise, developed Buddhist practitioner, miserable. And it's a mark and this is a quotation, the mark of a wise person, it's an, of course coming from the East, not from the West, but the mark of a wise person is an enduring cheerfulness, a joyfulness that stays. This is the mark of wisdom, the sign of wisdom. And you can see it in developed Buddhists too, who practice. The Dalai Lama who giggles like a boy. You see a boy playfulness in him, so beautiful. He giggles and laughs like a child. And many, I've known many monks, met many monks in my life. And so, you know, there's just something light and joyful. The practice has to bring us there. It cannot leave us in a miserable truth. So we go on. Because what brings joy is not our patterns, but the opposite. Liberation. Liberation, the kind of truth in which we take ourselves less seriously. Our patterns become less serious. We take ourselves less seriously. Less self-importance. Chashivut atzmi. You probably know the quotation from Chesterton. It says, why can angels fly? It's because they take themselves so lightly. And if we live in a less constructed world, that means the sankharas are less constructed. We begin to deconstruct them. Less construction. The joy emerges. By itself. A good word for freedom is less construction, is to be unconstructed, unstructured, not in a prison of our structures, including the big structure, which is me, that thinks it owns the body, the world, the views, the self, the big structure of me that holds, is like that. We can't see anything except the me. Do you exist out there? Anyone exist out there? Anybody there? At this minute, what's really happening? A bunch of atoms, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, that's sitting right here, a bit of electricity in here, producing some noises, going out to other bunches of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, taking it in, vibrations in the ears, electricity in the brain. That's all it is. That's what's happening right now. So we need to kind of break out of the prison of the structure. And in the Buddhist world, we use the word emptiness, shunyata, or no self, anatta, to describe this. It's a very frightening word. It kind of takes the ground from under our feet. And it makes resistance. And many of you, or some of you, have already expressed this resistance. That means, well, I want to be me. Don't tell me about emptiness. I'm me. I mean, it's like emptiness is a threat. And it's also a concept. And we don't need concepts because more belief. And indeed, we don't need to believe in emptiness. So it's one of the big misunderstandings that has come through the Buddha Dharma, which is that we're all heading for emptiness, that we should design ourselves towards emptiness, that we have to get rid of the self, and that we have to be passive, withdrawn, disconnected, empty clouds, and then we're enlightened. Total misunderstanding. Firstly, nobody wants to get rid of the self. No, Buddha never said get rid of self. We need the self. You can't cross the street without the self. You get knocked down immediately by the next car. We absolutely need the self. The self is like the hand or the feet or the teeth. We need a self. So we can't get rid of the self. Nobody wants to do surgery like go into a monastery and the monk sort of takes a knife and pulls out the self and throws it in the rubbish bin. No, we don't. The self isn't bad. The self is needed. But if we understand the operation of the self, we see how much it is controlling us by its patterns, by its a sort of imprisonment. And instead of the negative, which is somehow the self is no good for us, we need to look at the positive, which is if we were less busy with me and mine and self, what would life look like? And that's a different question. And the one that answers would be we would begin to have a life perspective rather than a self perspective. You need translation?
No, I could hear.
You couldn't hear, fine. We'd begin to have more a life perspective, meaning that we wouldn't just look on everything according to how I want it and how I need it and how it's good for me and how it's not good for me and what I think about this and what I think about that and what magiali, what I deserve and what I need and what my relationships are and how they have to be and how other people have to be and how etc. etc. So we try all the time and be busy sorting our life so that the self is not threatened or challenged. So instead of that life perspective, the big picture, and the less we are busy with self, the more we can let in life. And the life perspective is a positive thing. It's a wild, playful, rich experience that comes when the self is taken less seriously, less the sankharas are less deep, less burdened. The Buddha never said there's no self. The Buddha simply said that the self is unfindable, that we can't pin it down. If we look, we will not find it because it's made of everything else. It's a kind of collection of all our experiences put together, plus carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and some electricity. It's made of everything else. The self is made of the world. We hold it in front of us, but it's not a thing. The Buddha talked about the unfindability of self. We can search throughout all the oceans and the seas and the mountains. We will not find where this thing is called self. Our experience is we have a center from which we look at the world. Our experience is we own the body. That's experience. But it doesn't mean to say there is a self there. That's our experience. But that's kind of belief. We believe we own the body. But as Christopher's funny stories go, when you go to the toilet, you don't look around and say, "Oh my God, a bit of me. I must hold on to it. It's mine. I mustn't flush the toilet and wash it down because it's me." There is, I think, in the Jewish mythology, it's a very nice way of describing this. And this is in the myth of the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. Ha'etz hadat tov v'ra. Which I think we can translate more authentically as the Eitz Hadat Tov Li Ra Li, good for me, bad for me. And it's that that we take inside as truth, Tov Li Ra Li, Tov Li Ra Li, good for me, bad for me, good for me, bad for me, that got us ejected from perfection. Paradise, Gan Eden. So, I. There is I. Good for me, bad for me. Good for me, bad for me. From the moment we're born to the moment we die. And what's on the other side? The tree of life. The life perspective. Not good for me, bad for me. Life perspective. The tree of life is sitting right in the middle of Gan Eden. But we went towards the tree of good for me, bad for me, and out we go. So I think it's a good metaphor, and it goes much deeper, because in Daat, the word Daat, knowing, is essentially dualistic. And good for me, bad for me is dualistic. But Chochmah, in Jewish, in the essence of the word, Chochmah is non-dual, is... about the big picture, wisdom, true wisdom is about the big picture, is truth, and is not just knowing, dualistic knowing. So it goes on, and I won't go into it more right now. So, if we drop the me point of view, what happens is we begin to see a bigger picture, which is life-centered, which is interconnected. We feel belonging to a much bigger world, and that takes its place. So, I had a note today asking me, what about having children? What about being in life? What about love and sex, attachment? What about, doesn't all of this meditation in a way destroy our passion, destroy our, isn't it neutrality? And I hope that to some extent I already answered that, because in the life perspective, there cannot be neutrality. In other words, Adishut, distance. A life perspective is exactly the opposite. And of course, to be a Buddhist is not, or to be a practitioner is not to be disconnected, cold, frozen, dead. It's to be right in the life, and to be connected to the life. And it's if your destiny to have children, to get married, to have relationships, to be in the middle of life, then you're right in the middle of life, but with less patterns called me and my what I need, what I don't need. And here is the issue, that if we have children and we are in life, but the more we are closed in the me view, good for me, bad for me, actually we disconnect, even from our own children. Look at the situation, for example, classic situation of a parent that doesn't want to let go of the children. So the age of 30 or 40, the parent is still Jewish mother, is still worried and worried and worried and worried about the children, instead of relationship. You think the children want that? No, of course not. The children want life perspective. The children want the parents to be free to be in relationship, not just worried and paranoid and owned. My child, I must be a doctor. My boy must be an accountant and prime minister. And the poor boys, just see me, please, will you? Me, don't put me into a box of a prime minister, your desires to be prime minister. See me, I'm here. You relate to me as I am. Look me in the eyes. You know how many children don't get looked in the eyes because the parents are full of their own concepts and their self and the children's self and ownership. I own my children. They're property of mine. So clearly no question that the Dharma actually encourage us to be in life, not out of life, not separate, not closed, but in life. One of the interesting words that is used for patterns or things that control us, that are unwise, called kleshas or obstacles. One image or translation is thieves, ganavim. That these qualities in us of smallness, our anger, our desire, our needs, our fears, our patterns and so on, they actually steal from us our true nature. Now, true nature is joy. It's not joy. And Buddhists are happy because when you throw away all the rubbish, and this room, by the way, is a very big rubbish bin. Doesn't look like it, but I can tell you there's lots of rubbish being thrown here in this room. When you take away the rubbish, what's left is joy. Suffering, dukkha, is to be known, is to be acknowledged, is to be experienced. But the default condition of living beings is joy. The experience of the living experience is joyful. On top of that, there may be suffering. We have to acknowledge it. There will be suffering. In the nature of things, but the joy is default, is there, is base. I have a nice example. Interesting example of creativity that the poet Keats said of a certain person, that he was empty. And he said it poetically. And he said, this person was the least of an egoist that it was possible to be. He was nothing in himself, but he was all that others were or that they would become. So he's talking about someone who is empty. Clearly, if you think that someone empty would be just empty and lost self and therefore lost person, you wouldn't know who he was talking about. He was talking about William Shakespeare. Clearly you can't say that emptiness is a problem and from there no creativity. Creativity is an example of what comes out of the emptiness. In other words, if you're so full of yourself, then it tends to destroy creativity. But this life perspective allows creativity. I think of it in my own life, my own life experience, when I've been many, many different things, don't fit together at all. They don't fit. I've got a PhD in biochemistry from Oxford. After that, I spent years picking stones from the earth in the Galilee and building my house with stones, years, with my hands. They don't fit together. And writing, I've written lots of books. I've done all these things. I know that I'm sure that the practice is the thread that underlies all the things I've done in my life, because it allowed me to be free and playful. More playful with whatever turns up. More dancing with whatever turns up. Less closed inside the label, inside what ought to be done, inside what other people do, inside what the self says. There's a beautiful image from the Tibetan tradition, the Vajrayana tradition, of Dakini. And the Dakinis are female kind of goddesses, a bit like Shekhinah, Shakti, but they're always dancing in space. They're female forms that dance in space. And it's a kind of image of playfulness when you're not closed in self, playful, free, dancing in space. Yes, you may not be able to rely on things, but there's a freedom there, and it's a dance. So, let's come down how it relates to us here. I think that we see the retreat as a process in which we see ourselves more clearly, we stop, we look, we see all levels of ourselves, we see, for example, our thoughts. In normal life, we don't see our thoughts. Many of you are saying, oh, I can't meditate at all, just full of thoughts. But in ordinary life, you know how many thoughts you have. At least here, you can see I have thoughts. And they're a terrible mess. Well, this soap opera, this opera Sabon that I'm watching all day, that's me. Oh, what a shock. That's valuable. That's what we're here for. We may think it's a problem to have all these thoughts. It's not a problem. We're seeing ourselves in the mirror at the level of thought. We're seeing ourselves in the mirror at the level of body. Pain in the back and here, stress coming out, breath not smooth, this tension, a pressure. It's okay. It's the patterns. It's the sankharas. It's the networks in the brain that are doing this to us. We watch them and they're painful. They're not easy for us. As we do this, we begin to see that we are made up of experiences. It's not that we need to see it this early. We sit down for 4 days on a retreat in Indore and we have a revelation of non-self. It's not that. It's that we see how we're made up of our experiences. That we are full of experience. This is our traces, our shikhvot, our layers, our peels. And we begin to see this and we open it and we deconstruct a little bit. And that tells us, about the difficulties, about the patterns, about the pains, and we slowly touch and go, we touch and go, and hopefully we are wiser, we are clearer, and we have less holding. We hold on to less all the stuff of our life. But there is another part that we're doing here. And that's as important, equally important, which is the life perspective, the non-self perspective. So you might think, well, I don't have non-self perspective. Everything I do is me, I'm there. It's not quite true. I once had a class, all of us, teachers, most of us teachers, I think, had classes in Israel of doctors. And in my class, the doctors found it really hard to meditate, to understand what it was all about. And so I asked them, when do you feel most connected and joyful? So the story came, well, I feel when I'm diving under the sea with a snorkel. I'm climbing the hills. I'm sitting by the sea on the beach. I'm lying down at the end of the evening listening to music. I'm playing with my small child. Actually, if you look at all these, and I would invite you now to imagine what times for you are most joyful. What for you, if you would have to say, what's the most joyful experience for me in my daily life? You'd find
I think that it had element of connected, being connected and being less full of self, being less full of what I need to do, what I need to be, the labels, the automatic. We have times here, even if we don't notice it so much or we don't appreciate it so much, we have times of simplicity. Two or three breaths when there's no problem. Then the back starts to shout and the brain starts to shout and the soap opera starts to do its thing and then our life appears to us. But we do have gaps of moment of just breathing and feeling, I belong, I'm here, settling down, I'm taking my place. Nothing wrong in this moment, nothing to change, nothing wrong. We're walking outside, oh, I'm not concentrating, my mind is going round and round, but wait a minute, I stop, and there's a tree in front of me, and we're just here, me and the tree. Just stop, and in those moments, a little bit of joy, a little bit of ease, a bit of quietness. If we pay attention to those moments, they are as much training us as the looking in the mirror and seeing the patterns. So we work with both. The joy is here. And we can touch it just in moments and feel it. And then the difficulty is there. And we can look at that too. And we can be bigger than both. And if we're bigger than both, we're in the life perspective. We're not in Tovli Rali. We're actually the tree of life. Thank you. So let's sit quietly for a couple of minutes.